edition up here at the front.
This is the magazine that Margaret talked about. It's just restarted in Canada. It's a big project. I like the term you used yesterday. These are non-absconding copies. So we'll leave them here if you want to consult with them. And the card is there, too, with my email address. If you're interested in the magazine or if you want to get on the list for my columns, the email is there. First of all, I should just say I'm very grateful to be invited to speak here to you. You know, Father Roger and I have known each other for about 15 years now since we met in the seminary, and I've always thought of him as kind of an older brother, so when he invited me to come and talk, I was flattered in that sense. And then when I saw the other speakers, I'm not a philosopher who's written 67 books like Peter Kraft, and I'm not a man of letters like Bishop Kennedy. I'm a newspaper columnist. Not just a newspaper columnist. I think it's a noble thing, but it's not quite the same as the other speakers. But perhaps because of that, I want to talk a little bit about this subject in a way that maybe you weren't expecting, and not the way I was expecting to do it when I first accepted. I'm not really going to talk about the substance of the issue, because most of you actually are probably very up to date on what's at stake in these religious liberty issues, what are the principles, and if you weren't at all paying attention to these issues after the last 90 days, where there's been an avalanche of commentary, both secular and ecclesial on this, you probably are up to date. But what I want to talk about is how do we as priests handle this issue given our responsibility of proclaiming the gospel, which is slightly different than the subject of the, or substance of the issue itself. As Roger mentioned, the American bishops have an ad hoc committee on religious liberty. This was something that they sensed was coming. That is, or rather, they sensed that what was coming was a series of challenges on religious liberty issues in the United States. So at their June meeting of 2011, they decided something had to be done about it to sort of galvanize and organize their, coordinate their efforts. And as you, those of you aware of how the Bishops' Conference works, they have committees for different subjects. They have a pro-life committee, a family committee, a doctrine committee, a liturgy committee, and that's where most of the work goes on. And it was their judgment at the June 2011 meeting that they wanted a special ad hoc committee, which they're usually very resistant to, because they have all these standing committees, so, and bishops are rather busy, so they're not interested in another committee if someone else can be given the job. They decided to have an ad hoc committee because they thought that the situation was sufficiently urgent that it required a special response. This was June of 2011. August of 2011, for those of you following the Health and Human Services insurance mandate, the initial rule, which was confirmed in January, which provoked the big storm, was proposed actually in August. So they were confirmed in their view that there was a serious challenge afoot. So in their September administrative meeting, they decided to establish this committee. Bishop Laurie of Bridgeport, now recently of Baltimore, was made the chairman of it. And you get a sense of the importance of a committee by who's put on the committee. That's the decision of the president of the conference and the senior leadership. And so this committee is chaired by William Laurie, Archbishop now of Baltimore. And it has some of the more, if you want to say, prominent and combative voices in the American bench on it, like Archbishop Chaput of Philadelphia, Bishop Tom Olmsted of Phoenix, Archbishop Neinstedt in St. Paul. Bishop Papraki, whose role in the committee seems to make everybody else seem like they're still kind of wet, basically. He's the real firebrand. And there are other bishops, obviously, on the, there's 10 of them in total. And then the consultants for the committee, which I'm a consultant, are the non-bishop members, and that they include John Garvey, president of Catholic University of America, Marianne Glendon, president of the Pontifical Academy for Social Sciences, and the finest flower of Boston Catholicism, I guess it is, as she is. Rick Garnett, I think he's the associate dean of the law school, or anyway, a lawyer at law school at Notre Dame. Carl Anderson, Supreme Knight of the Knights of Columbus. And so when you have a meeting where the Supreme Knight and the President of Catholic U and Marianne Glendon are present, that when they don't have a shortage of other things to do, it gives you a sense of the priority that this has been given by the American bishops. and the Catholics in the United States. That all being said, and you've been following all the back and forth, I'm sure, about that. If you just look on the back of your sheet, it has helpful resources. I'll talk about some of these. But the last three there are all USCCB documents that are worth reading on this issue. First one is Cardinal Dolan's letter to his brother bishops. It was a private letter to the bishops, but they leaked it at the same time, so it's meant for public consumption. And I think it's on the website now, so it's not even leaked, it's just published. That was this letter giving an update on the situation, rehearsed the issues very well. The statement of March 14th, which was the administrative committee, which is about 30 bishops, they meet in between the plenary meetings and handle whatever business is pressing. A very good statement, United for Religious Liberty. If you haven't read that, I would encourage you to do so. And then this document that Father Roger mentioned, it's called Our First Most Cherished Liberty, which is what Benedict XVI said in his ad limina address on the 19th, the most cherished liberty, speaking about religious liberty. And that's the statement of the ad hoc committee. It'll be coming out in April or May. It's being translated into Spanish at the moment and being laid out and so forth. So that will be forthcoming soon. So those are resources that you can check there. The statements, I think, show a very united and vigorous response. I'll tell you what my fear is, and this is speaking as my profession, not my vocation as a priest, but my profession as a journalist, is that this is an issue in which the church could lose either way. It can lose if, for example, all these provisions go through, and so the Catholic institutions are forced or put into the dilemma of having to choose between their work and their faith, which is what everybody's protesting about. But even if the Catholic Church, led by the bishops, win, you know, the administration withdraws or changes its mind or is defeated or there's a court decision or so forth, you have the bishops of the United States engaged and the Catholic community of the United States engaged in a very intense, justifiable political battle, which is not an evangelical battle. It could be an evangelical task, but it doesn't have to be. You don't have to be Catholic, you don't have to be Christian, you don't have to be a believer to promote religious liberty. Right? In the same way, you don't have to be Catholic to be pro-life. You can have a very successful pro-life initiative that's not evangelical. You can have one that is. The two are not opposed, but you have to be conscious that this project, necessary though it might be, is an evangelical project, not just a political philosophy project. And that's why I say that I'm afraid that you could lose, the church can lose either way, because even if we have a very successful political philosophy, public action project, if it's not a gospel project, then it's not the church's primary mission. Okay? Do you understand the point I'm trying to make? So if we have these ad hoc meetings and you have very senior people around, very impressive bishops and archbishops and people like the president of Catholic University, and we spend the whole day discussing things relevant to this project, and at the end of it you think, well, what did we do to advance the gospel today? That's the kind of fear that I think we should have. And what I hope to help you do in the time we have is to make some suggestions, really, for when you're discussing this in your parishes or chaplaincies or seminaries, whatever apostolates you have, that in discussing this issue, which is going to be galvanizing over the next 6 to 8 months, it's going to be, especially with the election coming, you're going to have lots of material on this sort of thing. Do we do it in such a way that it also helps people learn the Catholic faith and become better Catholics? That's what I hope to do. Because I think it's possible to do it without that. To have a successful public campaign that's not an evangelical campaign. Let me just step back for a moment and to help you understand how I think about this. I learned a very useful distinction in public campaigns, whether political campaigns for election or public controversies, between strategy and tactics. I think that's been very helpful for me to understand and to give my advice in some of these matters. I learned it from a lecture given by Dick Morris. You know who Dick Morris is? Dick Morris is, was a counselor, kind of political guru to Bill Clinton, and then he split with the Clintons, and now he's more or less, I think, on the conservative side. Converted to Catholicism, has a very devout and sincere faith, but he's a very ambiguous character. I mean, so I'm not endorsing Dick Morris's view of anything. But on this particular view, he said you got strategy and tactics in case of political campaigns. And he said you can win on tactics and lose on strategy if you don't know what you're doing. Now, some of these don't have a choice. This was the example he gave. He said, and this is what I heard him, in the 2004 election, when those two great statesmen, champions of American public life, George Bush and John Kerry, were running for president. John Kerry, perhaps not the finest flower of Boston Catholicism, but anyway, I'm sure you're very proud of your local senator here. So they were running in, I'm just from Canada. I'm trying to be nice to my friends here.
Be nice.
By the way, you heard yesterday that in Peter Kress talks, the New England got it bad. New England and Canada got it bad, and the media got it bad. So I said to him yesterday, so now we've got
the Red Sox.
So we've got a Canadian journalist speaking at a New England gathering. That probably doesn't rank very high in his category of worthwhile initiatives. Anyway, so John Kerry and George Bush are contesting the 2004 election. Dick Morris's point was this: at the end of the election, which was fairly close, the Kerry campaign had discovered that the Bush administration and in the administration of the war in Iraq, there were some weapons that had been seized and they lost them, right? Remember, I don't know if everybody forgets these things, but the Bush administration, they lost them. They seized a whole bunch of weapons from the Iraqi army and they put them somewhere and the American military lost track of them. And this was very embarrassing, and Kerry was hammering Bush on it day after day. Because it made him look incompetent, and it was a weak point. The administration of the war was generally not his strong suit. Morris's point was that on tactics, Kerry was winning. That was a good thing. He was outmaneuvering on that tactic. On that issue, he was beating Bush every day. He said strategically, it worked to Bush's advantage, because the conversation was about the war. And in 2004, when you're talking about the war and security and terrorism, that whole set of issues was to Bush's advantage. So even though on the particular issue, the Bush administration looked bad because they had some sort of fiasco with these weapons, as long as the topic of discussion was the war, that worked to Bush's advantage. Strategy versus tactics. Right? So they won the tactical battle today, they lost their strategic dimension. I found that very, very helpful, maybe you will too, in understanding public campaigns. Let me give you an example from the church. So in 2008, I was in Sydney, Australia for the World Youth Day. I went about 3 weeks ahead of time, and my job there was in the Cardinal's office, preparing a lot of text, a lot of talks he had to give, working and all that for the papal visit in the World Youth Day. And about a week before the World Youth Day, I think literally the Sunday before, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation launched a ferocious attack on Cardinal Pell, based around a sexual abuse case in which he had written a letter which was not true, basically. In which the Cardinal admitted he made a mistake in his letter. Don't have to go into all the distinctions of the case. But it basically involved a man who was 27 years old at the time with the abuse, a priest with whom he had a homosexual liaison, and the aftermath of that. So a huge thing, of course, you know, front page of all the papers, the television. It was actually the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, a television network, and then it was spilling over in the papers. So this is the week after the Pope's arrival.
Before the Pope's arrival.
And so, you know, you're in one of these, I don't know if you've ever been in one of these situations where you're feeling under siege, incoming fire, and it's all very very tense. And Cardinal Pell's general instinct in all situations is to fight, right? It doesn't matter what the situation is. It could be serving dinner, or it could be or it could be a big, you know, battle in public life. So his instinct was to fight, and so he goes and gives a press conference, and so forth. And then the week goes on, and I said, I think that's enough. you know, it's not a winning issue for us. But, you know, he felt his integrity was being questioned, which it was, so he was going to do more. So he gave an interview about the whole case, sit-down interview. And I was staying at the residence, so I come home one night, and it's about 8 o'clock, the show's coming on. He says, let's watch it. So we sit down and watch the interview, and he answers all the questions, or watch the interview. And he says, well, Raymond, what do you think? That's very good, wasn't it? And he'd been discussing that this case was not what he was accused of. It wasn't a rape case. It was. So I think it did very well. It was a good interview. And I said, well, you did well. You did answer the questions well. You were confident. You got your points across. He said, but you're not happy. I said, no. He said, why not? I said, well, because, I said, any night, Your Eminence, on which the Cardinal Archbishop of Sydney is on national television in Australia discussing the distinction between consensual sodomy and rape is not a good day for the gospel in Australia. He didn't find it nearly as funny as that. But anyway, he still lets me come around, so it wasn't catastrophic. So he thought correctly that he'd won the tactical battle that interview, which he had. But strategically, he was losing. Because there's no advantage to the Archbishop of Sydney being on discussing the finer points of some particular immoral act. Strategy versus tactics. So what I fear is that in this big battle that is now underway, tactically, the Church in the United States, bishops and others, may win various points, even convincingly. But strategically, if it's not related to the proclamation of the gospel, and in fact, if it seems like the Church is showing its savvy and sophistication in public controversies and political battles, it may actually be counterproductive. It may be. I'm not saying it has to be. Right? Because actually, if the strategic question is who's more effective, right, who's the bigger gorilla in the political arena, that's not the gospel. Right? That's not the mission of the Church. So how does this whole battle then give us a chance to speak about the gospel? That's what I'd like to suggest with that strategic versus tactical thing. I hope it helps. It helps me understand these things. So what I'm proposing, I'm not proposing to go through all these topics. I've just made a list of things. And my thinking is this, is that when you're having a talk in your parish, whether it's in the homily or it's some kind of other thing, or you're writing to your people, or you're having a seminar or whatever, what is it about this issue that can help our Catholic people understand more about the gospel of Jesus Christ? That's my goal in what I'm hoping to present to you. Right. So the first thing is why, the first topic here is religious liberty, theological roots. I think there's an opportunity here to talk about freedom and why freedom is important. Now, you're Americans for the most part, and so freedom is our thing, land of the free, etc. But why does it matter to Christians? Why does it matter to Christians? That's not a bad question to ask. People are very interested. Right? Not as Americans, right? But as Christians. And to give us the opportunity to talk, I just listed three very basic things there. Freedom and creation. That God is free to create, first of all. It's the first number in the catechism, I think number one in the catechism. And in his creation, what does he want from his creation? Well, you know, the mountains and the lakes and everything else give him glory, reflects his glory as the creator. But above all, what he wants from his creation is a free response that only the human person and the angelic persons can give. So the purpose of creation is to create, one might argue, or the purpose of creation is to show forth the glory of God. But one way in which the glory of God is shown forth is the creation of free creatures who can do the one thing that God doesn't already have. And everything else he already has. The one thing he doesn't have is a free response. The one thing he doesn't have, the only thing we can give him that doesn't already belong to him, is how we use our freedom. How the angels and how men use their freedom. The logic of redemption. The debt incurred has to be paid. Why didn't God just cancel it out? He could, I suppose. But he desires that the debt be paid by a man. exercising his freedom, which is the logic of incarnation and the redemption, or one possible logic of incarnation and redemption. And the gift of salvation. It's a gift. Bishop Kennedy spoke about that this morning. The principle of the gift means to receive and to be grateful, which are acts of gratitude. Which are acts of freedom. Right. So, in a certain sense, even talking about why freedom is important to Christians is a good dimension of this issue, I think, is to highlight. Okay. That this is a theological question and not just a political philosophy question. And that's a difficult challenge, because it's easy, especially in the United States today, the Americans, more than most countries, are knowledgeable about and proud of their Constitution. Occasionally you run across Americans, I find it kind of amusing, but public figures will say, they'll take it out of their pocket, "I carry the Constitution with me wherever I go." I don't know any other country where people do that, you know. I think it's kind of odd, actually, a little bit too close to the state. But anyway, but it is that's the reality of the United States. People are very proud of their Constitution. They're quite knowledgeable about it compared to other countries. And this could very easily become a dispute about the First Amendment or the Bill of Rights. And as priests, we're not political philosophers. We're not statesmen. We should take advantage of it to talk a little bit about the theological purpose and roots of freedom. For freedom, Christ has set you free, right? So Corinthians. What's that? Galatians. That's why it's good to have your older brother at all times. Galatians. He was bad enough before he had the iPad, and now he's got that. He's got whatever he needs to doubt. Now he has the capacity to check. The second thing is to speak about religious liberty vis-a-vis the limited state. Religious liberty is the reason why it's often called the first liberty, the reason it appears first in the Magna Carta, the liberty of the church, appears first in the American Bill of Rights, appears first in the Canadian Charter of Rights, freedom of conscience and religion, does not appear first in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But the reason it appears always so prominently is because if conscience and religion are not free, all other liberties are in peril. So it's often called the first liberty. And I think that's the title of our doctrine, isn't it? Our first most cherished liberty. Yeah. But there are biblical roots to this, and it's an opportunity to talk about Jesus and what he says, and to talk about church history, which are always good things. So the first thing is obviously the two great episodes in the Gospels, beautiful things to talk about, is render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, render unto God what is God's, and to talk about that. In your life, in our life as disciples, what are we rendering to Caesar? What are we rendering to God? We have to decide about that. And then, of course, we just had it in Holy Week, the great drama between Jesus and Pilate. You know, if nothing else, in these months of dispute and controversy, if we could frame them in the context of one or two biblical passages that would become would be for our people a renewed chance to look at the figure of Jesus Christ, that would be a good thing. What was Jesus like before Pilate? What was Jesus like before these questions? And that's why I think pushing in that direction will prevent this from, for the church, being a solely secular battle. And then I've just listed their history. Depending on the forum you're in, we can lift up people from human history, the church's history. Augustine, if you want to do something on more, you know, the intellectual foundations of the separation of the city of God and the city of man, Gregory the VII, and all the controversies there about who governs the church, Thomas More, of course, and John Fisher, there as well, and then totalitarianism, the big challenge of the 20th century. One of the things I'm most proud of that the ad hoc committee has decided to do is that in this letter that's coming out is being proposed what's called a fortnight for freedom. And it's to begin on the 21st of June, which is the vigil of Thomas More and John Fisher, and to end on July 4th, which is the death anniversary of Pier Giorgio Frassati, but in this country I think it has other significance.
St. Elizabeth's
Portrait. St. Elizabeth's Portrait. So it might be a little harder to work St. Elizabeth into these issues, but hey, that's what the calendar has for us. So, and of course, Independence Day here. And the idea was, is that of course we're going to ask our people to pray about these things, but to have a focused time, it's not going to be, it won't be a national issue. It's a proposal for local ordinaries and their presbyterates and parishes to have special events, whether it's a mass or holy hour or something about this. And in the context of St. John Fisher, St. Thomas More, St. John the Baptist, St. Peter and Paul, first martyrs of the Church of Rome, there's a lot of liturgical things. I think Sacred Heart is just before that this year. Or maybe it's in that, I can't remember now. But that's not really one of those. There's a Liberty Feast. But there's a number of liturgical items, and then, of course, Independence Day. So both the liturgical and the secular history, holding up the idea of the heroes of biblical heroes and heroes of church history in terms of the limited state and of the the impermissibility of the state treading on the things of God. It was proposed, I think, at our first meeting in November. I was very keen on it, and it met with very wide support. So that's a very practical thing. By the way, the bishops already, the ad hoc committee, has prayer cards. I think if you go on the website, the bishops' conference, they're there. There are prayer cards. They have a St. Thomas More prayer card, the prayer for religious liberty, and very savage Our Lady of Guadalupe card, which I don't think she has a strict religious liberty dimension, but if you're going to do prayer cards, you can't beat the Lady of Guadalupe. They may even have a Padre Pio card, I'm not sure, for just sheer popularity. But so there's very practical things in sort of the liturgical life of the church. And, of course, Christ the King is also going to be held up, because that's a feast that has very specific religious liberty history to it. I'm not sure what will be done for Christ the King. It comes after the election, which gives you a sense, right? People are not so enthused about Christ the King. It's after the election. Something will happen in Christ the King, or at least a call for something to happen. But it shows us we have to broaden our vision just beyond the election. So all that is an opportunity to teach our people about what actually happened with these biblical characters. Peter, Paul, St. John the Baptist, what's happened in history, people have done this. And then I would say the American experience, probably not relevant to most audiences, but if you're dealing with people who are interested in American history, in American church history, to speak about that this is a particular flower of America, the American experience, the thinking about religious liberty. It's not an exclusively American thing, but the experience of the United States in terms of religious liberty and the freedom of the church. You can go back, I think, in the document, Our First Most Cherished Liberty, the speech of Cardinal Gibbons when he was made a cardinal in 1876. I think it was later, but anyway, his speech at Sainte Marie Trastevere, defending the American experience, I think we quote from that in that document. So if you've got a church history group where people are interested in that, talk about what Americans have actually contributed. And then finally, the Second Vatican Council. We're getting ready in the context of the Year of Faith to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Council. For most Catholics today, the Council being 50 years now in the past, have only the vaguest idea of, it was a major event in the life of the Church and had big changes in the liturgy. But, more than that. So one document, very relevant, of course, is the Dictatus Romanae, okay? The Declaration of Religious Liberty. I've listed it out in the back. So that might be something worthy of study. I've listed on the back there the actual document, Declaration of Dignitatis Romanae Personae, 7th of December. If you're interested in the history of that document and does it actually change church teaching and so forth, Cardinal Dulles did an article in First Things in 2001, which is very good. And I might as well mention it here. Evangelicals and Catholics Together did a very good statement. It was published in First Things in March of this year on In Defense of Religious Liberty, which draws on both Catholic sources, including the Dignitatis Humanae, and Evangelical sources. It's excellent. And in fact, when we were in the drafting of the document in December, and I got the draft. I wasn't involved with the Evangelicals and Catholics project, but I got the draft And I said at our next ad hoc meeting, it was a telephone meeting, I said, well, you know, I gave my suggestion, just we could just find a way to use this draft. It would save us a lot of work, but we didn't do that. Of course, you can't have too many things making the argument, but it's an excellent document. So those are things that to introduce our people to, and it could be a good way to, if for the Year for Faith, we're talking about the Second Vatican Council, this is a very topical thing, and so let's go back and find out what the council said, you know, especially if you're in a college campus and students who would be certainly capable of dealing with these kinds of documents. I think it gives us a chance to clarify a lot of misconceptions. My principal work is a college chaplain, so I live in an environment where questions of liberty and conscience are more often misunderstood than understood, and it's a lot of work is devoted to trying to clarify those things with our students. So I've listened to some confusions here, and I think in presenting or teaching about religious liberty, we have a chance to correct some very frequent confusions. The first one is conscience is the highest authority. And now that we're into this thing, and you've got bishops of the United States talking about conscience rights, and people talking about conscience rights, and people say, well, what does conscience mean? It means that I shouldn't be forced to do, right, what I don't want to do. So if the issue, by the way, just step back for a moment, strategically what's going on in the public square is the bishops and others want to make this an argument of conscience. Because as long as we're talking about conscience, the bishops win 80-20 probably, right? And the administration wants to make it about contraception. As long as it's about contraception or sexual license, they win 80-20. So that's kind of the argument we're going to be having for the next 6 or 8 months. But when we talk about conscience, what do our people understand by it? Cardinal Pell, who I mentioned earlier, does not talk about the rights of conscience. He said we should not even use the word. A little awkward for moral theology, but he's not a moral theologian. But he said it's so misunderstood that we should talk about truth. He said people understand truth better than they do conscience. But so this is something to talk about. Conscience, is conscience the highest authority? And if you read Dignitatis Humanae number 2, people get all, there's all kinds of mischief, because it seems to say, well, isn't the church saying that everybody has the right to go out and find what is the what is his highest truth and to adhere to it, et cetera, et cetera. But the reason there's more than two numbers in Dignitatis Humanae is they also, you're intended to read on. And number 3 says that the highest norm for human behavior is divine law. Right? So this is, I don't have to clarify it with this audience, but it's a time to talk about what conscience is. That conscience is the way we adhere to the divine law. It's not the way we create a law for ourselves. I mean, you fathers all know that. But many of our people don't. It's a massive area of confusion. And so if we're going to be talking about rights of conscience, it's a good time to talk about that conscience isn't opinion. Conscience isn't my initiative. It's a response to something outside of myself. Right? For those who are in the university environment, of course, Cardinal Newman, a guide in this area. The question about the right to error, right? The right to falsehoods. Says, well, I know that's right, Father, but you know, they have a right to do something different. And when we have a culture where we talk about everything in terms of rights, it's a difficult question for us to clarify, but it's not a bad one if we get the chance. Is that there is no right to sin. There's no right to lie. There's no right to commit adultery. By the way, one of the great lines in this, I think it was Archbishop Chaput, was being interviewed, and the question comes up, well, you know, Archbishop, for goodness sake, 98% of Catholics, you know, contracept, even as we speak. That wasn't this question. Right now! So, what's the big deal? And he said, well, look, he said, a lot of Catholics commit adultery, but if the government forced us to commit adultery, we would have a legitimate response that that's a violation of our religious liberty and our conscience. I think he also mentioned avoiding taxes. He was trying to do something to the right, something to the left, very savvy. But to clarify that there isn't a right, right? And this is a, that it might be wise, from the point of view of public policy, not to prosecute various sins, but one cannot claim a right to it. That's a very important thing, especially for young people, when they realize that rights are tied to some kind of vision of the good life. We'd say the virtuous life, the life of holiness, but that these rights come from somewhere. They're just not asserted or nothing. That's a little bit more sophisticated point, but I think it's one that's useful to make, because probably 98% of Catholics who are not all contracepting but may think this, actually, that rights are things we assert without a reference to some vision of the good life. In an individualistic culture, which America certainly has, that religious liberty is not an individual right alone. And what we're fighting for here is actually a vision of the social order that includes people acting together. So it's not just a bunch of individuals and my right to do a certain thing. And then separation of church and state, which is, as you know, it's not in the Constitution per se, but it's in the constitutional history of the United States, and has a very, it's a venerated principle. And that doesn't mean the separation of religion from public life. It doesn't mean that the exclusion of religious citizens from public life. And there's a lot of confusion about that. And so this would be a good time maybe to clarify it. And finally, I put this on there, the First Amendment. It's not an evangelical thing. I don't mean to offend my American hosts by suggesting the First Amendment is not a sacred text inspired by the Holy Spirit. But it does cause a lot of confusion. And my great mentor, as Father Roger mentioned, Father Newhouse, his book, The Naked Public Square, which is about many things, is actually a long argument about the First Amendment. And his argument is that the First Amendment is not two clauses, that is the No Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause, which is how the American Supreme Court generally interprets it, but that the First Amendment is a single clause, the one religion clause, and the No Establishment Clause is for the purpose of free exercise. It's an argument he makes in The Naked Public Square. But that's a good thing, but for those who are more constitutionally oriented, that might be something to clarify. So what's going on? What are the attacks on religious liberty? If I gave this talk a year ago, I might have to point out all the things that are going on, but now everybody's very familiar with them. And how do we respond? How do we respond in a way, when we're detailing attacks on religious liberty, to point out how this is an invitation, or at least an illustration of how we ought to live. So the first thing is the violation of individual conscience, that the government might force you to do something that you do not believe in. And why is that wrong? So an opportunity there to talk about formation, on specifically formation of conscience, which is, as you know, a huge, huge, huge issue in all of the Western countries, or probably the whole world, actually. What does it mean to have a formed conscience? Why is it so important that our conscience should not be violated by the government? Why are we so excited about that? Why are we so implacably opposed to that? Because conscience is so important. Well, why is it so important? And if it's so important, then what are you doing about it? What does it mean to have a formed conscience? That's a massive program. But certainly we have a right, we have an opportunity here. The second attack that we encounter, narrowly defined freedom of worship. I was most distressed when the Holy Father arrived in Great Britain and was received with great warmth and grace by Her Majesty the Queen. And the text that was given to Her Majesty for that occasion, the British within the British Foreign Office, spoke about the importance of Britain's long history of freedom of worship. Now, one might, aside from historical accuracy questions on that, you don't expect Her Majesty to go into a long history there with the Holy Father. But she talked about freedom of worship. And this has been pioneered, I'm sorry to say, by the American State Department, yes, which has been the principal rhetorical change from previous administrations, is that the Secretary of State and the President use the term freedom of worship when they speak about religious liberty, which means something. It's part of religious liberty, but it doesn't exhaust religious liberty. And you can see, perhaps, when people first, 3 years ago, were calling attention to this change, and now you can see why. Right? This was not an accidental rhetorical shift. But the administration talks about freedom of worship because they don't believe that the St. Vincent de Paul Society is a religious institution. Right? That's the position of the American government at the moment. the St. Vincent de Paul Society is not a religious institution. So when we talk about freedom of worship, it's clear how does restricting or messing around with the St. Vincent de Paul Society, what does that have to do with anything? They're not a religious institution. So this freedom of worship issue is a critical one. That leads to the other point, the definition, the exclusionary definition of religious institutions. Right? And from when the bishops speak about this, by the way, this is what actually concerns them almost as much as the content of the mandate is the definition of what the religious institutions are, which you know the definition proposed by the administration for what constitutes a religious institution excludes everything other than basically a parish. So anything that involved not in the inculcation of religious views or in the treatment of your own people is out. So the St. Vincent de Paul Society, even though everybody's there because of their Catholic faith, is not a Catholic institution. As with the universities and hospital, we know that all very well. This is a beautiful opportunity to talk about faith in our ordinary life. That our faith is not limited to Sunday morning. That our faith is not only going to Mass and praying the rosary at home, but it has a corporate dimension in the world, that we get together as Christian disciples to serve the common good. And that's not an optional part. It's not an optional part of the faith. Okay. Interestingly enough, a very good place, Roger will help me out in a moment, but I think in Deus Caritas Est, I think it's there, part two, second part of it, Benedict speaks about the three indispensable tasks of the church are to preach the gospel, so preaching, right, sacraments, and the diaconia, the charitable works. So, I mean, if I got that correctly, Roger said, part two of Deus Caritas Est, Benedict's saying that the three things without which the church cannot be the church include everything that would be under the St. Vincent de Paul Society sort of
no less indispensable to the mission of the church than the proclamation of the gospel or the celebration of the sacraments.
Right. So it's as important as the Holy Eucharist, as important as preaching. So I mean that's about as high an estimation I think you could say it. And we have to defend that. Not just defend it against the government who says you don't recognize it, but for our own people. And say that if you are super faithful to the sacraments, and if you are leading Bible studies at home 4 nights out of 7, but you are not interested in the diaconia of the church, something is missing. Obviously, other things are still praiseworthy. So this is a great opportunity to emphasize that to our people. What do we have next here? The ministerial exemption regulation of religious hiring. Well, one of the things that this, by the way, this Hosanna Tabor case was a case that just decided 9-0, and basically was the issue was, would there be, did religious institutions have First Amendment protection in their hiring and firing of people? So can you hire according to religious grounds if you're running a Catholic institution? This was the Hosanna Tabor, which was, I think, a Lutheran school. And, you know, people have been so under siege when the decision came out, 9-0, ad hoc committee was, you know, euphoric with excitement, which was good. But it shows how precarious these things are because the question was at the Supreme Court to begin with. 10 years ago, this case would not have even got to the Supreme Court because they said this is absurd. The position, by the way, of the administration was that the First Amendment did not apply to religious employers any more than it applied to a union or anything else. And the judges said, that's absurd. It's a religious freedom amendment. How can it not apply to religious institutions? But the point that it got to the Supreme Court, that it was 9-0 shot down, that's good, but still. But here's an opportunity to talk about, well, why is it important for us as parishes, as schools, as universities to hire people or to be able to hire people according to their religious identity and practice? Because that's key to our identity. So how are we doing on that? We have every right to say to the government, you have to acknowledge that, but how are we doing on that? How are our parish staffs? How are our choirs? How are our faculties of whatever? Right? To invite an examination of conscience is that do we, if we insist that our religious identity is critical for our religious missions, our enterprises, do we pay attention to that? Do we care about who we entrust things to? Do we challenge the people who are involved in our in parish leadership or diocesan leadership to live the gospel that they're supposed to be advancing? And we all know that's a big mess. Right? We all know it's a big mess. But that, it's always been a big mess. I mean, obviously, you know, we're not a church made up of, you know, legions and legions of saints to take all these jobs. But are we trying? That, I think, could be a very powerful examination of conscience if we are willing to address that. I think it's important to reinforce Catholic pride, that we make a contribution to civil society. We don't have to be embarrassed about that. We're not asking for some special thing. And to point out that that religious people overwhelmingly are at the heart of civil society. That religious people give more. Religious people give more time, more money, and so forth. And that so what when we're defending the rights of religious institutions in our common life together, we're not a threat to the common good. A large number of people in the United States and in Canada think that religion is a threat to the common good, even people who are personally devout, because they've absorbed that from our culture. We need to give them confidence that that's not the case, even for just basic self-esteem reasons. That's also the last point there, the strangling of civil society. But I put one other thing here, that, and now this is where on the contraception thing it comes to the fore. If the state is insisting that a certain moral position is the settled one that has to govern public policy, like that every woman has a right to contraception paid for by someone other than herself, or that schools must teach that homosexual unions, lifestyles, marriages are equivalent. For example, this is the big, we're having a big fight over this in Ontario at the moment. Well, there's a religious liberty argument to that. And to say, well, you shouldn't force us to teach what we don't want to teach. But there's also, it's a moral question. And so it's a moment where we can actually speak about the substantive moral issue. Now, it's not really the government. We don't have to justify to the government. You know, we don't need a moral theology discussion with the government. Oftentimes, oddly enough, though, congressmen, senators, secretaries of health, presidents, seem to they make for a moral theological argument, and you think, well, you know, it's not really your role to do that. But for our own people, we certainly, why is it such a big deal? Why are we so worked up about this contraception thing? Why is it that everybody knows three things about the Catholic Church? That we're against abortion, against divorce, against contraception. Why is that? Everybody knows that. Maybe we should try and figure it out. Why is it that we're so determined not to, in our schools, teach the equivalency of homosexuality and heterosexuality? Why is that such a big deal for us? Are the bishops just sort of digging their heels in because they want to be recalcitrant? Or is there some actual truth we're trying to advance? Some of you fathers probably have, in the last few months, taken advantage of that already to clarify. Certainly, there are more questions that are emerging, right? So, I can move in right straight with crooked lines, as they say. So these issues, when we're in the dispute, let's not let the substantive issue pass. One of the things, you know, I'm very close to Cardinal Dolan. He was our rector in the seminary, and he's been very good to me over the years. And I'm on this committee, I'm sure, because he thought that I could devote some of my free time to these projects that are dear to him. But one of the things interesting in the last 3 months is he's given several interventions on chastity in which he said, you know, look, we haven't been talking about this. We've kind of dropped the ball on this. He gave a beautiful homily in St. Patrick's where he said, look, you know, when the second reading was
March.
What's that?
No, it was
January.
January.
I mean, he gave a homily in St. Patrick's. The second reading was the flee fornication from St. Paul, or avoid immorality, as I believe the American. Yeah. And he said, you know, look, he said, I read the readings for today, and my initial instinct was not to preach on the second reading because it's better to talk about something else. And he said, isn't that how we thought for so long? So I had to kind of steel myself to preach on a chastity. And he gave one of his great homilies saying, you know, isn't it the case that everybody thinks we're kind of weird and strange when we talk about chastity? So here's an example of addressing the substantive issues that are there, and there's a great opportunity to do it. Okay, so evangelical challenge. I'll go through this very quickly. In the context of speaking about religious liberty and defending religious liberty and having rallies and having all kinds of, you know, public debates and letter-writing campaigns and people petitioning their congressmen and all this kind of stuff, what are the things we ought to, I think, propose to our people? And this is a bit colored, I'll admit, by my work as university chaplain, so it may not apply in, you know, a typical suburban parish, but it certainly applies on campus, is to speak about the Christian story. What is the great Christian story? And one way to think about the Christian story, about, you know, life and history and the meaning of the universe and all that, is the great story of God's freedom meeting our freedom, right? And of course, our freedom is a created freedom, but that this is the great drama. This is what Christianity is about, is giving an explanation of how God's freedom meets our freedom. And that's an exciting story. It's not the story of a remote, aloof, and somewhat disinterested God kind of coming down and raining on our parade, which is how a lot of people might think about it, right? Or an aloof judge who's suspicious of our goodness, and if we kind of get it together, we might be able to, you know, escape past him. So, I think the chance to tell the story in a way that, you know, especially in the United States, freedom is the great, should I say God? Is it the great God? I don't know. But it's the great sort of common value. So talk about Christianity is the story of the great meeting of God's freedom and man's freedom. And then there's something I find very powerful with young people. I don't know, maybe high schoolers is too young, maybe they're not thinking it this way, but certainly students on campus. Is what great purpose are you going to use your freedom for? Every young person wants to use his freedom for some great purpose. There's no one, I've never met one who doesn't. There are others who might think it's not possible or they're discouraged, but everybody would like to say that I'm going to use my talent, my time, my resources, my education, my friendships, my athletic skills, my dramatic skills, my money, whatever it is that I've got, for some great purpose. What am I going to use it for? And on campus today, the great advantage that we have at chaplains on campus is that there's no one else who has an answer to that question. That's not always the case. In previous generations, there were other answers to those questions. Some of them weren't Christian. But today, there's no answer. The university, at least the one I work at, has no answer to that question. No proposal. I think that if we're going to talk about the importance of freedom, let's talk, okay, fine, let's defend our freedom against the government. But then what are we going to use it for? What is the great purpose that we're fighting for? Why bother having it? It'd be like defending your fortune at all costs, and then once you've secured it, you don't do anything with it. And then, to help our people think about the country being flawed and the culture being hostile. If you, the principal evangelist of this view is Archbishop Chaput in Philadelphia, who says things that probably for most Americans are hard to hear. When he says, look, let's not think that America is the shining city on the hill. It's a depraved culture. It's a hostile government. He doesn't say the word regime, but eventually he'll get around to that. But to help people be critical, the flip side of Americans' laudable pride in their country and their history is that they can also be blind, right? And when you're not American, you see this, that there's a view sometimes that obviously things are not good here, but they've got to be worse elsewhere. Why? Because we're Americans. They've got to be worse elsewhere. They couldn't be better elsewhere. We're Americans. We're the best. That's a view, and it's led to a lot of noble things in American history. But to help people see that there are serious problems in the culture around, and because of that, it's not good enough just to look to what's going around. We have to look somewhere else. We have to have a criterion against which to measure our culture, and that criterion for us as Christian disciples is the gospel. And then finally, that political action is a means to personal conversion, which is basically the summary of my entire view. So that in our minds as pastors, we're priests. You know, we're not political organizers. And so in our proposals, in our teaching on this, in our galvanizing the people on this, even if we're actually leading them, you know, 10 busloads down to a rally at the state capitol, if that's what you're doing, and that's probably going to happen at some point in this, how is it a Christian thing? How is it advancing personal conversion? Otherwise, we're strategically, we're tactically maybe very successful, but on the wrong battlefield, right? And as if a general, you're tactically brilliant and you defeat the, and you win the battle, but you're actually fighting in the wrong battlefield. It's not advantageous. On the backside, fathers, is just some list. It's just a list of useful texts. All of you I know will be writing messages or preaching homilies on religious liberty. There are libraries full of things, but the things that would be most relevant to the current situation. Obviously, if you're not familiar with the Gathatis Romanae, which is the foundational teaching document, it's there. Cardinal Dulles' interpretation of it. He basically answers a question here, which is this a new teaching or is it a continuity? I don't know if Roger remembers this, but Roger, once we were talking about this, and he said, Raymond, the thing is, you got to remember, which means you got to listen to what I have to say. But, he said, you got to remember, Raymond, the church cannot change 180 degrees. She cannot move 180 degrees from what you taught before. 178 is okay, but not 180, right? Which is an exaggerated point, but that's what Cardinal Dulles was set out to do. And he's very frank, he's very honest. He says it's not easy to just say, oh yes, this is in total continuity with everything that came before. He explains how it is, but it's not easy. So this is not going to come up in most fora, but it's good to know, you know, this is such a contested issue. So I recommend that's a very short article in First Things, then the document, the recent one on religious freedom, then the three from the USCCB on the bottom, and in the middle, three things that Benedict has spoken about on religious liberty. The World Day of Peace message, you know, every January 1, the Pope issues a document, a kind of social doctrine document, and it deals with different aspects. The one for 2011 was on religious liberty, so it's on this topic. It's a very high priority for the Holy See. He addresses it all the time now in his addresses to diplomats. The unlimited address to American bishops on the 19th of January, that's a slightly easier document and useful for quotations if you want to say, you know, when the Pope met with the American bishops 8 weeks ago, this is what he said. And then the homily he gave in the Plaza of the Revolution in Havana just, 2 weeks ago. He spoke at some length about religious liberty, and especially this point that religious liberty enables religious believers to make a contribution to the common good. So that's very recent. Okay. So
9 minutes for questions.
I thought you said 5:15.
That's when we're praying.
Oh, okay. Sorry. We have to. By the way, I want to apologize for Rogers. He, by accident, there was 9 minutes free time after lunch today. That was not intentional. It was. But by the time we had the schedule, we couldn't fix it. So anyway.
Right.
Yeah, Joe.
You said we could lose the battle either way. Seems to me, haven't we already lost the battle when our own people are responsible for putting culture of death candidates in office? That they just don't get it. Or even Cardinal Dolan, who was on Fox News, was asked the question, can Catholics vote for Obama? And his response, while trying to avoid, what he said was, well, that could do more harm than good, his response was such that someone who voted for Obama the last time said, you know, even Cardinal Dolan says I can vote for the guy. That could be the way it's interpreted. Because as far as the people are concerned, Catholics who are unwitting and not, you know, up on, you know, the unwitting Catholics, they look at what bishops do and have done with culture of death politicians, and it looks like the defense of issues, of central moral issues, isn't important to them. So, they're up there receiving communion, getting Catholic burials, and the people see this, and they say, well, you know, this isn't a real big Catholic problem.
Well, you're raising, Joel, a very wide range of issues. I have a lot of sympathy for bishops in this regard, in that it's a very difficult place to be. In terms of Cardinal Dolan, he does have, like, I'm an enormous admirer of his, but he does sometimes, when he gives interviews, get into the history professor analysis. He talks, analyzes the issue as opposed to gives his answer, which sometimes causes the confusion you mentioned. I mean, if the question is, are we in a difficult position because we've already lost some battles along the way? The answer, I think, to that is indisputably yes. But that's where we are. And look, I mean, Cardinal Dolan says over and over again, we didn't ask this fight, we don't want it, which I think is true. But there is an element of it where sometimes being under attack kind of galvanizes and focuses attention on things. So even if we're in a difficult position, it could be a salutary experience. It doesn't have to be, but it could be. He said something for Ash Wednesday, which I thought was very, very good. One of his, only he can do it, those beautiful sort of short things. He said, look, it was Ash Wednesday, he said, when it's easy to be Catholic, it's hard to be a good Catholic. And when it's hard to be a good Catholic, when it's easy to be a Catholic, it's hard to be a good Catholic. And when it's hard to be a Catholic, it's easier to be a good Catholic. So, he's addressing the fact that we're in this battle, there's a bit of a challenge. My hope, the point of what I'm trying to suggest to you, fathers, today, is that because we're in this situation, and it might be more difficult to be Catholic, let's hope that, therefore, it's easier to be a good Catholic. But we have to have a conscious push in that direction. And if all this is finished, and the public policy battle is lost, but there are hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of Catholics who better know their faith, who better thought about Jesus Christ and what he said to Pilate, or thought about church history and an encounter with a saint who was heroic, that's not a bad thing. That's my point. That's not a bad thing, even if the public policy battle doesn't go very well.
Right.
Yes?
You use a formulation towards the end of your talk that I did not understand. You said that we must tell the story of the encounter of God's freedom with our freedom. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that story is. I've never heard that. What are you talking about?
It's going to make me seem stupid. I said the Christianity is the answer. But what I was trying to say, Jay, was that one way of explaining the Christian story, you can say, what's a Christian story? Well, one way to say it is it's God's love. Right? It's God's love for sinful creation. What's one way to explain the Christian story? It's God manifesting his beauty, his goodness throughout the world. There are different ways you can present the basic Christian story. And if we're all hot up about liberty issues, one way to present it is that the Christian story is the story of God's freedom encountering man's freedom. So, does that help or not?
Man's freedom is a faithful response. God's freedom.
I can try to explain it. Did most of you get what I was trying to say, or is that right? Not all right? Well, there's one way to explain it. What's the whole story of creation, redemption, salvation, and so forth? Is God is a free actor, and he uses his freedom for creation, and then he gives his creation freedom to respond to him. And how we make that response, and how God then uses that response for his greater glory through redemption, the drama of redemption, salvation, is one way to tell the Christian story. But if it's not immediately clear, then that makes not a good idea. But anyway, that's it. Peter?
Concerning strategy, Linda Couture, the wife of your colleague there, Kim Vivian, who has this Living with Dignity organization to basically pro-life, when she counsels, she and others who counsel us on how to deal with the government and in public fora to speak about abortion and euthanasia and so on, don't mention religion and don't mention the Bible. These are issues that can be dealt with as a human, because as soon as you mention those things, they dismiss you. Mm-hmm. But you're saying something different. We have to say these things.
Well, this is my point, is that what Linda says, which is not bad advice, is how to win a tactical argument.
Right.
And that's why, I mean, that's why the American bishop some years ago had Helen Albrey as her pro-life spokeswoman, because the thinking was that a woman speaking very, in her case, a very gifted, articulate, attractive woman is better than, you know, an old bishop with his cufflinks and jowls, you know, trying to lecture the people. So that's a tactical thing. But my point is that if the tactical advice on how to win this argument is don't speak about the faith, don't speak about the Lord Jesus, don't speak about the Bible, don't speak about that. Okay, that might be good public policy advice. And we can have Catholics in the public square who do that. But I'm talking to priests. I'm talking to priests who are exercising their contact with the people in a pastoral situation, a chaplaincy or a parish or whatever. And if we don't speak about the gospel or the Bible or the Lord Jesus, then what are we doing? That's my point. And so that's a good tactical advice, but it's strategically bad advice for a Christian pastor. If you were running a lobby group, you know, life or dignity of life lobby group on Capitol Hill, and that's how you're going to do it, that's fine. I'm not questioning that. But I'm speaking to priests in the context of the new evangelization, or any evangelization. And this is why I say I'm worried, because what sounds like very compelling advice, it's not good advice. It's not good strategy for the pastors of the church. Right?
Just like to add to it, here in Massachusetts with the gay marriage battle, for example, we fought an away game the entire time, where even to our own people, we were talking with natural law argumentation, whereas it motivates so much more to talk about Jesus and marriage, because that fires them up. It's not necessarily our extra argumentation, but ad intra, it's crucial for us to play home games in order to fire up the troops, in order to be able to go out and battle. And I think the main strategy is to save people. And the tactic is beyond just this.
You mean to get to salvation. Salvation is the main strategy.
Salvation. And the tactic of religious, the whole battle of religious freedom, we've got to bring on to that larger issue, because if we, you know, if we win religious freedom but lose our souls in the process, what have we gained?
But that's the main argument. Anyway,
the souls and trust.
I think I have room for one question. But, and by the way, if I know I used to send some backhanded compliments towards Boston, but if you're not going to play home games when you've got the 100-year-old most beautiful ballpark in the country, opening day is Friday, 100-year season, you're mad. Play your home games if you've got to play home park. Okay, now you raise the issue, so let me just say.
Get him, Rand.
Who was the last team that won two back-to-back World Series?
We did. Toronto Blue Jays.
And what happened in 92 and 93? Toronto won the World Series. What happened in 94? Who won the World Series?
Nobody.
Did they cancel the World Series just because the Canadian team won two in a row?
No, three. The Expos would have made
exactly.
The
exactly. And who was leading the NL when they canceled the season?
You're talking the American National game. Let's talk to Canadian.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
How about the Canadian champion?
It's a difficult thing.
Okay, last question.
All right. February 2010, gold medal game. Now, Peter.
I can't really get you. I guess that what I hear in some senses in the street is use, and I think this is the bottom line for your topic, is we've got to use this as an opportunity to evangelize and sanctify our people. Bottom line.
Right.
We haven't had an opportunity to bring these issues to the forefront, political, which, and freedom, but also contraception, also sterilization, and abortion. We haven't had an opportunity, and the government is giving that opportunity to us.
Right.
Right across every national paper across the country, let's use the opportunity. They're doing it for us. They're bringing it to the forefront. Let's use it as an opportunity to evangelize, catechize, and sanctify our people.
Yes, and if you want, you know, back to Joe's comment about Cardinal Dolan, if you saw his interview on Easter Sunday with Bob Schaefer, mm-hmm. Face the Nation, you know, they talk about various things, but at the end of it,
you know, as he does very well, the Bob Schaefer asked him, it was a friendly interview, but they talked about all the issues and says, you know, what's the challenge for the church? By what he kind of meant was, you know, how are you going to handle this with the election year or whatever? And Dolan said, see, the challenge is the same as the first Easter Sunday, is to propose Jesus Christ, that life is stronger than death, that hope, you know, is triumphs. And then he went on to explain the kind of the gospel in summary. So, as pastors, that's our role. And so I think, Peter, you summed up what you wanted to say. I originally planned to come here and give a talk on for religious liberty as a, you know, political, philosophical thing and the role of the church and et cetera. But then it occurred to me more and more that as priests we have a slightly different, significantly different role to play. One of the things that's happened in almost every English-speaking country, including England, where you wouldn't think it would happen, certainly in Canada and now in the United States, is that on issues of great public import, the minority group, namely Catholics, who are not a majority of English-speaking countries, have been given or forfeited by others the role of taking the lead on this, on these kinds of issues. So the Catholic bishops in England and Wales have a very prominent role. Catholic bishops in Ontario and the rest of Canada, Catholic bishops in the United States. So it's not obvious why it should fall to Catholic bishops and Catholic priests to lead these kind of battles. It's not only our fight. But anyway, that's how it's turned out to be. So we have this role thrust upon us, and it's a service to the common good, but we have to be careful to exercise it in a way that's consistent with our primary mission, primary vocation, mission of the church, which is to preach the gospel. So, thank you. God bless you.